Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, this is John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. Welcome back, everybody. We're going to bounce into this podcast today. Everybody's kind of busy, and I've got Mark Cobb back. If you remember Mark, he was on a few podcasts ago where we discussed topics around purchasing a firearm, all the different characteristics that went into the selection that I made, along with some of the recommendations that he had for all the listeners out there. So I found that really valuable and entertaining. So we're going to talk today about scopes and bullets, and it's going to be a topic. And we also have Josh Stryker back. Josh has been working today, so he'll be a little bit tired, but hopefully he's got a few things to add. So we're just going to start the conversation with all of us and just get right into it. Mark, Josh, you guys on the line?
Yes, we are.
Awesome. All right. So I introduced everything. We're just going to kind of run today. And Mark, I kind of want you to kick this off. And one of the topics I just want to start off with, just basic, is you had a shoot recently. I got to attend that. I didn't shoot in it. Josh actually fired a few rounds in there, did pretty well. And you also shot at the event as well. And I just wanted to give you a chance to talk quickly about that and maybe some of the, I don't know, the fallout or some of the discussion that resulted at the end of it with the competition and who won and why and some of the things that you just observed. So maybe run on some of those topics.
So we have our shoot once a year or so. We just try to get a bunch of guys all together and we try to expand it so that, you know, there's a lot of different levels of shooters that show up. There's guys that have full Monty precision rifles that are shooting F-class. And then you have guys like me that, you know, that I bring like my Terminus down. That's kind of like your more upper to middle class kind of guns. And then we also have guys that literally bring their 1970 model 700 and they just kind of run with what they got. And it's always interesting just because you want to try and get more people interested and find out what they can kind of do with their equipment, you know, and we don't want to have the people that are trying to get into this that want to try and get in with your bare minimums for your setups to try and think that you should be competing against these guys that have almost triple the investment or triple the time into reloading or anything else. Like you kind of want to have a level playing field. So we try and break it down as far as like factory guns, custom rigs, and then custom unlimited, which is basically like your high-end precision rifles, like your F-class rigs or your bench rest guns, anything like that. And we just have a good old time. You know, it's mostly just for fun. It's just a good time to get everybody together. And, you know, the main event that we kind of do is we do a running of the hill where we each shoot. You have five chances at each target, which is about 18-inch, 12-inch for the first five or six targets, and then you come up to about 18-inch, and you get five shots at 200 yards, 300, 4, 5, 6, 8, all the way out to 1150. We jump out to the final one there, and as soon as you don't make contact within your five shots at that target, you're eliminated. So, you know, it's fun to get everybody together and see what they can do, see how they improve from year to year, and I don't know. It's a good time for me. So,
all right, that's good. Josh, you got to shoot in the event, and I'm not sure how often you shot in events like that, but maybe just give a little bit in your perspective what you were shooting specifically and just what you felt about the event.
I thought the event was great for what they got going on. I mean, there's not many places you can get a 1150 yard range.
Yep.
You know, you don't have that around every corner, so it's pretty nice to go down there and shoot. I brought my 22-250, which is my coyote gun, and my 7mm 08, just my deer setup. That's all I brought. I don't have many fans. I have one gun with a custom barrel on it, but I'm still trying to find a load that shoots really good out of it. So I just brought my hunting guns. 7mm 08. I don't know what happened. I can't remember if I was out at 300 or 400, and the 22-250. I think it was 500. I don't know if the wind was pulling the bullet just enough, but I was all around the target, just couldn't hit the target. But it was good. It was fun. A lot of good guns. A lot of things I hadn't seen before. Some fancy guns. Just a lot of guys have a lot of money wrapped up into those guns.
Yeah.
So it was pretty cool to see.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I was impressed with the investment these guys have in these guns, and they're not normal looking rigs, right? They're not like our typical hunting setups. And you know, that one gentleman had some type of bipod that had like, I don't know, some compression. I don't know. It was just
hydraulic lift.
hydraulic lift. And I'm like, boy, that seems complicated. The gun was as big as he was, and I was enamored in the fact that, you know, a group of guys could get together like that, and it's a good learning experience. I wish I could have stayed longer, but I had some family obligations. Mark, I want to talk quickly about scopes, and, you know, I think it's always an important topic for folks that want to invest, you know, into a scope, or what they want to invest in, you know, what their budget is, and that kind of drives a lot of decisions. You kind of have a mantra or a slogan that you like to, I think, suggest to people, you know, just in general buying scopes. Then I want to get into some of the specifics. Then I want Josh's take on these things. He may have a counterpoint or two. So why don't you just kind of talk a little bit about scopes at a high level?
I think I just start the whole conversation off with this. So I really got back into shooting probably in 2018, 2017 is probably when I really started turning my tables towards shooting more often and getting more invested into like the precision aspect. Say 2016, 2015, you would not have convinced me on this, but I live and die by this now. I would rather spend more money on an optic and putting it on a crappy gun or a basic gun than taking your, you know, a real high-end gun, like say if you're getting into some of them Browning, the real, real high-end fancy guns and starting to put like a real low-class glass on it, you're just spinning your wheels. If you can't see it, you can't shoot it. To go back to that shoot, this is kind of like a test for me. I have a Remington 700 ADL 270 that's my normal hunting rig. That was what I grew up with when I first got into rifle hunting. And it had a Burris scope on there. Well, I finally took my own words of advice on this when I upgraded scopes on there. And long story short, I ended up coming in second overall the whole day with just it was a Mark IV HD 2.5 to 10 by 42 scope on it. It's a really nice piece of glass. It's not top of the line, but it was way better than the Burris that was on there. And I'm, like I said, this is just a basic synthetic stock. Nothing's been tampered with. My rest that I had was literally two flat rocks with a sandbag on top. So, I mean, the glass is huge. Obviously you want to have something that can shoot like a 1-inch group. That obviously is a huge aspect, but just being able to see it and to be able to make calls as far as the winds, the distances and things like that, that you'll be so much farther ahead than say just going out there and spending the most amount of money that you can on the gun and then just saying, oh yeah, I can just throw this $500 piece of glass on there. It probably will work for 200, 300 yards. But when you start really trying to push it, really trying to get your precision down as far as your wind holds, it's just not going to hold. So that's probably my lead off comment on that. And then before we get too far into all this too, scopes are kind of like vehicles and stuff, you know. I'll start right off by saying I've become a huge Leupold fan. I'm not saying that Leupold is the best of the best of the best, but I have gained my trust in it, just like, you know, say a GM pickup might gain my trust as in a pickup truck. You gain your trust in that optic because it doesn't fail you when it matters. And if it does fail, you know, the service is there to get you back up and going as fast as possible in a painless stroke, I guess, per se. And to me, that's huge. You know, Leupold has always been, I've had one pair of binoculars that went back and it was like within 3 weeks, I had a brand new pair of binoculars. These were not registered to me. They weren't anything to do with me. I bought them used off of a buddy and I dropped them off of a shelf and no questions asked. They replaced them with a current model, not the outdated one that was there. So to me, that just means a lot. And then, like I said, that's not the only brand out there. I know Vortex has a good warranty on it, but good glass with a good serviceable company behind it is huge. That should be your number one priority to me.
Yeah. I can't agree with you more. And I think that's the reason why I have been, you know, in tune with using Leupold for the past several years. But, you know, me personally, like I have a Zeiss, I've got Hawk, I think I have a Nikon, and then I have a bunch of Leupolds, and I've been impressed with pretty much all those scopes. The one scope that I've wanted to, well, I think I mentioned this last time, I was looking at Swarovski and I was looking at Trijicon, and I love the Trijicon glass. I felt like that was one of the, I don't know if they have like a multi-spectral coating on it, but it just seems super clear. And that was, you know, the sharpness in that scope seemed better than most scopes that I had looked through, but it was just a weighty scope. And I just didn't feel like that would match well with my setup. But anyhow, you know, everyone has their own opinion, but I would agree that, you know, if somebody's going to warranty something, even not to the original owner, that just says a lot about that company. And, you know, take that to the bank. You know, I've had the same thing happen with, you know, I think I mentioned this maybe in another podcast. I had a rangefinder break and no questions asked. It was definitely out of warranty, I'll tell you that much. An electronic device like that, they typically don't replace, and they did. I got a brand new unit. Mm-hmm. Like, I, you know, at that point, that really kind of pushed me to say, hey, maybe that's a better company to kind of look towards to purchase. And again, you know, there's been multiple guys in this podcast and we haven't talked specifically, but I know Mills knows a big Vortex guy. He's tied in with those people. So something has to do with familiarity and just your past history, those around you that kind of give you ideas and concepts of, hey, this is a good product. And, you know, it's better to try more things. I'm kind of that kind of guy, try more things. But once you find something you like, you stick with it. I want to bounce over to Josh real quick. And Josh has, I think, more of a hunting perspective on things. You know, one thing I'll give to Josh is Josh has always, you know, been very practical about things. That's his forte. He's got a kind of a good mindset, I think, when it comes to, you know, just thinking through things just from a, you know, just being reasonable, thinking about the bottom line, what's he spending on stuff, and he's really getting the value out of it. Josh, what do you think about spending a lot of money on scopes? You think it's crazy?
Depends on what you're doing.
Okay, let's talk about
For somebody like Mark or a lot of the other guys that are big into the long range shooting, you put a cheap, you know, 3-9x40 on it, it's not going to get you anywhere. I'm a huge Leupold fan too. Every one of my rifles except two, which is my 22-250 and the one I'm trying to get dialed in, which is a 270, they all have 3-9x40 Leupold scopes on them. That works great for me. I don't, other than a mule deer out west, I've never shot a deer past 100 yards. And I've shot my fair share. So for somebody like me to put a, you know, Mark, I don't remember what your scope is, Mark, like a 6-24 power or something?
Oh, my 5-25.
5-25.
Yep.
So for me to put that on one of my hunting guns makes no sense. The 3-9x40 makes sense. But to take that gun and think you're going to go shoot, you know, 1,100 yards and be competitive, it's not going to happen. So for me, for the scopes I run, they work good for me. Inside 300 yards, that scope's going to work good.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you there at all. And again, I think it's use case, and I think it's looking at some of these other factors, and that precision piece of it's important. Let's kind of drill into the scopes, and let's kind of walk down the different things that we would consider, Mark, whether it's, you know, magnification, objective lens. You and I had a debate on that before I bought my scope. Any type of consideration, reticle, that's a big thing for some folks. Some folks don't like, you know, illuminated reticle. Some do. I think Trigicon adds the fiber optic. Whatever the case may be, let's kind of walk through some of the considerations and factors in choosing a scope, and maybe one might be more preferential or choosy as compared to something else when you're looking down the list of items, when you're, you know, ratioing and weighting things.
So for me, like, there's actually more options that you have to ask yourself, to me anyways, when you're looking at an optic than you are the gun. So like for starters, you need, once again, like going back to the rifle thing, you need to be practical about what you're trying to do. I'm going to bounce it back and forth to try between two different guns. My Terminus has a 5-25 Mark V on it with a 35 millimeter tube, big objective lens. And then my 270 that I was just talking about that has that 2.5-10, 30 millimeter tube, 42 objective. So I'll break those numbers down in a minute, but like the main one there that most people are very familiar with and fluent with is the zoom ratio. 2.5 is going to be your low power. For me, with my Terminus, I got nervous a few times because there's a few spots that I sit up in that you could have a deer that pops out, you know, from behind this tree at like 40 or 50 yards that you had no clue was there or something like that. If you're got buck fever on and everything is going crazy at that moment, you're going to have a really, really difficult time trying to find a deer and keep your composure, figure everything all out at a 5 power or above when you get like less than 75 yards. That's to me, it's almost like a petrifying feeling. That's why with my 270, that's more of like a rifle that if I am in like closer quarters, that like my farthest shot's going to be, you know, 200 yards, 300 yards or something like that. I'll probably take that rifle just for the aspect of, okay, if something pops up close, I have it on that 2.5 power. I should be easily able to see the whole field of view that I need to see and get a shot off and just it's smarter is really what it boils down to. So number one, I would say is zoom ratio. As far as being practical, what zoom ratio is going to be best for you. Second would be, to me, that once again, this isn't going to matter for most people, but now you're starting to look at like second focal plane versus first focal plane. Most people do not have a clue what this boils down to. Probably a lot of people didn't know that there's two different options. Most people are only aware of what they call a second focal plane scope. Second focal plane is going to be the cheapest to produce. It is probably the most common that is out there. Second focal plane, when you're looking at your reticle, when you adjust your magnification in any way, shape, or form, the reticle will always stay the same. So for, like, say if you have a 3-9 second focal plane and it has the BDC or the little hash marks or any sort of reticle on there that has some sort of holdovers for it, when you have it cranked all the way up to 9, that's when your ratios are going to be correct as your reticle. Like, say if you got a TMR, which is going to be, a half of a mil or a tenth of a mil or whatever for each one of those notches, that is going to be only at full power, which is fine for most people with a 3-9, because the only time you're going to be doing any real holdovers is probably at 300 yards with a 3-9 cranked all the way up. That's probably fine. It's going to be more than what I would like to have it at, but you can still get away with it. Now, if you're trying to get to like 600, 700, 800 yards, anything like that, that's more like when you're starting to get more in your precision stuff. But first focal plane, when you are adjusting your magnification, the reticle actually grows and it compresses like with the ratio that you're at. So if you don't have it cranked all the way up to the max and you're trying to hold for X amount of wind for X amount of crossover, or you're just trying to hold over, over its back and hold on to that second hash mark, it is going to be right at any given ratio. The downfalls to it are the two main ones. One, they're expensive. Two, I have found, speaking from experience, I did not do enough research on one of my reticles. And when you get in a hunting situation, low light, and you have it cranked down on like 5 power, and you're trying to shoot at a deer at 100 yards to say 150 yards, those lines are very, very, very fine. Once you get it cranked up, obviously, yeah, that's fine. You can see the crosshairs, but you're not going to be cranking it all the way up to make a 100-yard shot, at 4:30 at night just before the sun goes down. But you will not be able to see those crosshairs. So those are factors that I think that should be enunciated to the very, very max. And that just goes, they really kind of circle back to the same thing. What is the average range that you're really going to have to worry about shooting at? And then I guess the last one that I preach probably more than anything is obviously having good glass itself, but the objective lens. I touched on this on the last one, but the objective lens, to me, that is what gathers all of your light. That is, to me, one of the most crucial parts for like a hunting gun. Obviously that, the amount of light that the lens can gather is going to be, it just helps you as far as like trying to identify animals at certain times. Does it matter like to a very, very highest level? No, not exactly. But to me, I like the light gathering. It is just very, very crucial to me. So those are like the main things that I probably focus on the most.
So let's apply this in a hunting scenario. Most of the listeners here are hunters, of course, and we've got different perspectives on this. I think it's hard for folks to even understand parallax, first focal plane, second focal plane, some of this terminology you're using. And I know you try to explain it, but like dumbing it down for the regular guy, the guy that wants to go in and purchase something that's reliable, again, warranty's a piece of this. And I just was quickly trying to look up, hey, what companies have, pretty decent warranties. And I just got a list here. Bushnell, no questions asked, lifetime warranty. Vortex, they have a VIP warranty. I think it's unlimited and lifetime. Loophole's got their lifetime guarantee. Hawk, they have a no-fault lifetime warranty. Maven Optics, no-fault warranty on their products. So there's other companies with warranties. I just want to make sure it's clear that I want to be as objective as possible here. But like, if you're trying to make some decisions on what you need and what you should buy, let's give some basics. And I think maybe having like overkilling a magnification, right? Mark, I'm probably one of those guys that got that in his head. Like, no, I need 20 power. I need 25 power. And for my application, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense just based on the distance that I'm shooting. So let's try to be realistic and give some people some practical advice when selecting a scope.
So the one thing I do talk about this quite a bit. When I, like my Zeus there, my nicer gun, that one, I have that 5 to 25. I use that 25 power on that gun really for when I am sighting in a gun or trying to do a group, or when I am sitting in a blind and it's like, don't have to worry about low light conditions, but I am using it for observation only. When it comes to shooting, though, I always crank it down. So I think we touched on this last time. Josh will understand exactly where I'm coming from on this. Me and Peter were going circles for a few minutes, and I straight up told him, I'm like, you're not going to want to have that thing on 18 power when you're at 600 yards trying to shoot it. I said, you're not going to like it. You're not going to do it. You're not going to do it. And he tried it anyways. And what did you experience? It is hard to get a gun that is a hunting weight to get it to cycle back and come right back in where you can see your target. Whatever it be, the miss, the hit, the animal running off, and your target shaking, it is very hard. So God's honest truth, they're going to be somebody that's going to shoot at 100 yards at very, very most, and they're like, yeah, I just got this new scope. It's 6 to 24 power. And I'm going, what did you just do that for? And it's almost like a curse more than anything else. You need to be able to either have a gun that can track perfectly with no recoil, or you got to be realistic and start lowering down on your magnification. Because in reality, most people, when they hunt up to 500 yards, you really should not be shooting over like 12 power. I would take that pretty much to my grave. Like you really need to be able to see what happens after you pull the trigger.
Now, I want to bounce over to Josh real quick and just ask him a little bit about his perspective. I think this has lots to do with your comfortability with the firearm. You know, that whole follow-through sequence, kind of like archery hunting, where, you know, you're shooting your bow and you want to make sure you're following through with the shot. You know, as that arrow releases, any impact is negative. In this case, following through with the shot is always meaningful, period, meaning staying on target, remaining on target, following through that target, making sure there's impact, and then following that target to make sure it's a lethal hit. How do you look at this, Josh? Like, what's your perspective on this stuff? Because I think most people, you know, again, my myopic view sometimes is like, hey, I'm looking at this paper target. I want to just be dialed in as close as possible. I make the shot. I hit the point that I'm making, you know, I'm aiming at, you know, that precision shooting piece of it or accuracy. And I'm like, I'm good. But then I miss this hole or boat of it. And it was such a good conversation to have with you, Mark. So what do you think about that, Josh?
I say shoot with what you're comfortable with. I do things a lot different than a lot of people, including my guns. I mean, I'm about the only person that I know that chooses to hunt with a pump gun. That's just what I'm comfortable with. I spent years trying to find a rifle that I felt comfortable shooting. And, you know, good story. You know, just like anybody, you start doing your research, you can find oodles and oodles of information on these guns, guys doing reviews on these guns. I had this gun picked out. This is the gun I want. This is the gun I'm going to go buy. So I go to the store. They got one sitting there, the caliber I wanted. I asked the guy if I could see it, grabbed it, ran the action, pulled it out, handed it right back to him. It did not fit me. That was not the gun for me. And I would say most people wouldn't do that. They'd have it in their head that this is a good gun. This is a gun I want. I'm going to buy this gun. And they go buy that gun. Biggest mistake you can make. I spent probably a decade looking for a hunting rifle, and it wasn't until a buddy's dad showed me his, and that's how I got started with the pump guns. And I take it right down to, you know, you came up to my house to sight in one of your guns with me one time. Yep. You laughed at me. That is just how I do things. Yeah. You know, for me, I don't have the greatest setup. I'm not set up like Mark is, but it works for me.
There's another piece of this I think super critical, and Mark, Josh, you probably know this, right? I did testing with different products for years, specifically crossbows. So I had to do a lot of optics and looking at configurations and, you know, a whole host of measurements with the guns, and that whole sight eye alignment's critical. you buy a gun, it's got a comfort factor like Josh just brought up. And then that whole eye alignment is really critical, especially for just, you know, your eye focusing. And sometimes it's okay when you're looking through a scope to focus, take your eye off, let your muscles relax, and then focus again. Sometimes focusing for long periods of time kind of distracts your ability and consistency in looking through something or being concentrated on something, so to speak. So I think getting familiar with objects and your familiarity, your interfacing is really critical to this whole equation. So you buy a gun that fits great. I think about my Super Black Eagle shotgun. I couldn't imagine putting a scope on it because I'm just so comfortable with the way that gun pulls up, the length of pull, everything to do with that particular gun, that I think a scope would distract my line of sight when I'm looking down, you know, the bead of that, you know, on a turkey or what have you, whatever I'm hunting. And I've just kind of appreciated some guns fit. And when you add a scope to it, you know, it's critical that the scope eye alignment is just perfect. And I think that's another thing that people just kind of misjudge. And they try to fit to the gun, not to allow the gun to fit to them. And I kind of relate that a little bit to Josh's point that he was making there. Mark, I want to bounce over to another topic and reticle choice. And then I want to get to bullets and spend this last, you know, 20 minutes or so talking about bullets. Reticle choices are really difficult, I think, for a lot of people. I remember back in the day, I have a Nikon, I think it's a, what do they call that? Buckmaster. I think that's what it is. It was on my first rifle that my grandfather gave me. It's a 700 from Remington 700. I think it's an ADL. It's from the 1970s. Got a metal butt stock. Great gun. Super accurate. Boy, that thing shoots. And I think I bought my first scope. I think it was a 14 power. Nice looking scope, but I think it had like bullet, the BDC. Do you remember that? The BDC, the Nikon BDC.
Mm-hmm.
You guys might remember. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I thought that was the coolest thing at that time. And, you know, now looking at different things, I've had different reticles, different, you know, configurations that work for me, but maybe walk through your, you know, your choice selection. What makes sense for you? You know, is it just a typical duplex reticle that seems to work for a lot of people? What are things that you like in just like a regular hunting scenario?
So for me, like if you're looking at reticles, it's a whole, honestly, it's a disaster because there's just, like you said, there are literally so many different options. The two big obvious ones are, I would say, is if you're going to be talking about holdovers or anything like that, there's MRAD. I have three different scopes I'll be referencing probably in this. I have that Zeus that has the Tremor 3 reticle in it, which for somebody that is coming off of a basic duplex or even a BDC, it will drive you absolutely bonkers because there's literally so much information built into this reticle that show, that give me, it's a tool for holdovers for wind, elevation, the size of your target. The more you use it and the more you understand it, it is a very, very, very useful tool, almost more than any other thing on the gun as far as trying to make quick wind calls, quick moving to calls, anything like that. It's very crucial for. Then I have the TMR reticle that's on my 270, and that is just going to have basic notches going all the way down. Once again, it's all in mils, but there's no like Christmas tree to it like what my Tremor has. So my muzzleloader that I'm shooting right now, it is a high-performance muzzleloader shooting a 300-grain bullet, 3,000 feet per second. Obviously, a muzzleloader is not going to be like a target rifle. I am using this strictly for like hunting aspects. So to say that I'm shooting this thing out to 1,000 yards is dumb. Like, I do not do that. Like, it's 600 yards is what I try to practice to, 700 if I'm feeling crazy. But for most part, it's 200-300 yards. So for wind holdovers for that kind of yardage, you don't have to worry about. Elevation is a little bit different. On that gun, I have a CDS dial, which is a custom dial system from Loophole. Yeah, right up on there. You should take a little gander. Basically, when you buy one of these scopes brand new from Loophole, they give you a free dial and you tell them all your ballistics. And instead of it, like you turning your top turret, so it says one MOA or two MOA, you look at, you zeroed in for say 100 yards. When it is zeroed and that it's facing right at you, it says one. Then you turn it to two, you're sending it to 200 yards. You turn it to four, that's for 400 yards. It's just very simple. So that duplex on the muzzleloader is kind of fine for that aspect. Even if you had, like Peter, you're running the same kind of reticle on your you're 6'5", that gun is going to buck the wind very well. So you shouldn't really have to worry about wind holds too much. You're pretty much able to do the exact same thing with that. So for me, like, you just have to realize what you're expecting out of that reticle. I found with my 270, I actually have a dope card on it. And so I can actually just kind of focus on that. Okay. Yep. So you have to figure out from your reticle aspect, do you want to try and have something where you're dialing, or do you want to have it so you're doing all holdovers, or if you're going to go MLL or MOA, or if you're going to go MILS or MRAD. And for me, like with my, going back to my Terminus one, that one's a 5-25. So if you remember beginning when I was talking about how my first one, how I said it was very, very fine, I've actually gotten this one illuminated. I don't hardly ever use it except for when I have turned all the way down and the crosshairs are really fine and it is at like 4:30 at night. I want to be able to have that red dot so I know where the crosshairs are all the time. So those are like the main things that I look at when I'm looking at a reticle option.
Yeah, and I think each your own, and there's personal preferences, and again, the complexity of how you're viewing or using your scope for certain things, I think, is pertinent to your choice selection on what reticle matches, et cetera. All right, I'm going to bounce over to bullets, and I think, you know, this is where you are both more versed in this than me, certainly, and I'll try to not get into details here, but, you know, we've talked about buying, an average or complete gun, spending a little bit more money on quality scope, whether it's for the various things that we dialogued about. But if your bullet fails and it hits an animal and it's not lethal, or you are not comfortable shooting that gun, the accuracy of that gun is marred because the bullet isn't, you know, doesn't provide you the precision shooting that you want, that separates success from failure big time. And so choosing a bullet, I think, is critical in this equation. I think we talked a little bit about, you know, what my preferences were just because of my circumstance, right? I'm not into reloading. That's another time suck for me that I don't intend to think about. So, you know, I'm buying stock ammunition off the shelf. And again, is it a matching, you know, does it fit my gun? Does it shoot well out of my gun? And sometimes the magic will happen and that will occur. And sometimes it doesn't. So I want to talk a little bit about this, starting with Josh. And Josh, let's just talk your perspective. You've gone through this over the years. I mean, we used to shotgun hunt, right? Mm-hmm. In our particular area, having to match that shotgun round, you know, that's a painful process. And then inconsistent rounds, if you're buying factory ammunitions, trying different lots, and some lots are better than others. What is your perspective on bullets, making bullets, buying bullets, just at a high level?
If you spend more money on your ammo, that doesn't mean it's going to shoot better out of your gun. That's the first thing I'll say. Mark might be able to explain this a little bit better than me, but basically there's two different style bullets for a rifle cartridge. Your splatter bullets, three, there we go. Splatter bullets, which fragment, there's an outer case and an inner core, and solid core bullet. I'm a solid core bullet kind of guy. If I can put the bullet where I want it, I'd rather have a pass-through shot. I'm not saying splatter bullets are bad, but I've heard some bad things. You know, you hit hard bone and the bullet doesn't penetrate, those type of things. With a solid core bullet, I've never had them fail me. Never. If the shot's bad, then that's my fault, which has happened. But that's just my perspective on bullets.
All right, Mark. I liked the way that Josh kind of identified the different types of bullets. Let's take your perspective on things at a high level.
I align quite a bit with Josh. I had different sights on some stuff, but that's pretty much what this whole thing's all about, is there's definitely more options than just us three or two, you know. But there's three different kinds of bullets. The splatter bullets, like Josh was talking about, those are just like a cup and core. Cup and core bullets are probably the most consistent bullet. They're the cheapest to produce. And so, but the biggest downfall to them is when you're trying to use them for a hunting aspect, it tends to happen that the lead and the copper, or the copper jacket separate. So like he was saying, when you hit bone, or if you, they're going to literally explode. That's where, like, Barnes had some bullets out years ago. They're called like the varmint grenades. And then there's
I consider those splatter bullets varmint bullets. That's something you would go coyote or fox hunting with. You want an entrance wound, no exit wound. They go in and they fragment apart.
And so cup and core bullets are going to go in, obviously they're going to have your entrance wound, but they're basically designed so that they are going to just have huge shock that enters into the body of the animal or whatever that you're shooting at. Like, it is designed to basically go in there, and just the shock impulse from that bullet is basically designed so that it blows up bone to turn that into more fragmentation and just destroy everything in there. The biggest downfall to it, like Josh said, is you don't always get exit wounds on it. So now if it does run, because I have seen it, this has happened to me before, because I tend to lean towards the cup and core bullets for reasons that we'll talk about in a minute. But cup and core, you're looking for minimal blood at that point, because if you think about it, you're shooting at 0.284 or 0.308 or 0.277 inch hole through the hide of this deer, and there's no exit wound, so you have to think that you really have to focus on trying to find some sort of tracks or to really know what is going on. That is where Josh's aspect, as far as the bonded bullets, like AccuBond is probably one of the most common ones. There are some that are like locked, which have like a little crimpering into the lead to kind of hold the lead together. They'll have a partition, like Nosler partitions, the Nosler AccuBonds. You have the Remington core locks. There's Swift. I mean, there's a bunch of bullets that are just bonded bullets that are designed so that when they open up, that lead is bonded to the jacket. They're just going to mushroom, and they will more than likely penetrate all the way through. The biggest downfall to the bonded bullets in my eyes is that's one other step that has to be made from Nosler, all these Swift, any of these guys when they're manufacturing these bullets, it's another step. So I did kind of do some math before we got here. I'm just going to talk about like just a 7mm heavy weight per bullet, per caliber size bullet. You're looking at 95 cents a piece for a bonded bullet versus like an ELDM, which is just a basic cup and core bullet. They're 45 cents a piece. For the average Joe Blow that's probably going to shoot 20 to 30 times a year, it really doesn't matter. For somebody that's like me that really just wants to shoot, 200 times a year, it adds up. And being the process that you are bonding a bullet, the bonding process can be inconsistent. So now your bullet BCs might be different. So from an extreme long range aspect that I tend to obsess over more than I probably should, the bonded bullet just does not make sense to me. I have shot them before, and like Josh, I've never had bad luck with one. It's just, it's the cost efficiency, and they just tend to be not appropriate for just a target bullet, just being having the expense. The other option of bullets is copper. We're from New York. We are very well aware that, New York State now has it legally wise. If you are hunting on public land or state owned grounds, you're supposed to be using a copper projectile. This is something that is kind of new to me. There's two main downfalls to the copper. One, the density of copper is not as good as lead. So it is, if you physically look at a 160 grain bullet that's all copper, 7mm, it might be the same physical size as like a traditional cup and core 180 grain. It's a very long bullet, but you don't have the extra mass energy knockdown to it that like a cup and core would have. And two, copper tends to be more sensitive, because this is where we go back to practicality region of it, is you have to realize a lot of these bullets have an expansion minimum. The bullet has to be going a certain velocity in order to form. So a copper bullet tends to be more sensitive to, it has to be going like 2,000 feet per second in order for it to perform. A bonded bullet is about 1,900 or so. your cup and cores, that's when they tend to shine. That's why a lot of these guys that are doing the extreme long range hunting tend to lean towards cup and core, because your impact velocities are 1800 or so. You know, you're so much slower. You don't have to worry about jacket and cups and lead separation. They're just designed for the longer range stuff better. So those are like the main punchlines, I guess, when it comes to all three bullet designs.
All right. I feel educated. And that whole understanding of bullets, I guess, optimal performance, and then thinking through some of the minimums you have to have from a velocity standpoint, that consideration kind of went over my head, at least until you just explained it. Let's talk a little bit about just bullet design. I think that's a probably important piece of it. I'm assuming like weight, diameter, you know, measuring the ballistic coefficient. You mentioned that a second ago, you know, how a bullet kind of resists drag, the issues that we, I think, alluded to on the last podcast. And, you know, when you have a higher BC, generally it's flatter trajectory. It tends to retain energy a little bit better. And what I mentioned, I think, in the last podcast is windage or wind drift impacts are a little bit minimized. So I kind of want you to walk through maybe a little bit around this topic. Some of it has to do with choice for the game animal you're going after. You know, what weight bullet, I think, is something that people probably focus the most on, but I think there's other aspects of that that may be critical that maybe you can enlighten us on.
So BCs, I will just start off by saying, is ballistic coefficient. Basically, it is the resistance to change. As far as like the higher the BC numbers, like John said, it's going to retain its speed better. It's going to retain its energy better, which in turn is going to make it so that it doesn't get blown around in the wind as much. It has less factors going on with it at all times. For the most part, BCs really don't amount to a whole lot until you get to like 300 yards. And when I say they don't really amount to too much, like even at 300 yards, they really don't really come into, I'm not going to say they don't matter, but they really aren't as crucial as everybody online is trying to make it. Like there's three or four different apps out there. I usually tend to lean to the Hornaday app just because it's easy, but you can kind of play around with this yourself. If you take, say, Hornaday soft point versus like a Hornaday SST or something like that, both 130 grain, the SST is going to have the plastic tip on there, very, you know, slippery of a bullet design. It is made to kind of beat the wind better. If you really look at what it matters down to that, you really aren't gaining too much. However, when you do start stretching it out, or if you're shooting in the hard crosswind, that's really when your BCs really shine. It tends to be the pattern that the heavier the bullet, the longer the bullet, the slipperier it's going to be. So when they start talking about like bullet designs, as far as like the ogive, which when you're looking at a bullet, I'm sitting here with my hands up in the air, like you guys can all see me, but like the big long curve on the front of the bullet is called the ogive. The longer the ogive, the more slippery it's going to be. Then the piece where that actually sits into the neck of the case is called the bearing surface. That doesn't have as much of effect on it. And then when you get to the tail, that's where your other main crucial part. There's basically two different kinds of tails on there. There's actually technically three, but it's going to be way too hard to explain. And there's very few guys that are actually doing it. A flat base bullet is just like what it sounds like. When you get past your bearing surface, it is flat. They tend to say that if you're shooting out 300 yards, a flat base bullet is actually going to be more accurate and more predictable. The bow tail are the ones that like almost got like a football shape to it, where they actually start coming back in and narrowing down on the end of the bullet. That's like what a lot of guys are leaning towards more now. Even like an Accubomb, like Josh was talking about, like that we shoot out of like 270s and stuff, you know, they have a little bit of a bow tail on there. The bow tail is supposed to stabilize it more. So those are the main aspects to it. When you're looking at the weight of the bullet, a lot of people are starting to lean more towards heavier bullets. Yes, a heavier bullet is going to be harder to get it to go faster, but it is going to retain speeds. And like, if you look at going back to your, that ballistic apps, if you're starting to mess around with those, if you look at say 130 grain bullet, going back to a 270, say you're launching that thing at 3000 feet per second, and say you compare it to 140 grain bullet that you can only launch at 2900 feet per second, more than likely the BCs on the 140 are going to be better enough so that by the time you get to 400 or 500 yards, actually the 140 will be going just as fast, if not faster than the 130.
Josh, I want to bounce this over to you real quick, and I want to talk a little bit about bullet weight and selection, just from your perspective. We talked a little bit about choice for bonded, and you're at the point where you're building some bullets for, I think, your custom gun. We'll just call it a custom gun. You probably don't even want to refer to that, but that heart barrel that you have on that Remington Action. Why don't you just talk a little bit about some of your selections around that gun and just things that you were kind of deciding from a weight factor. What are you going to use it for? You know, you're going to go out west, those type of things.
That gun specifically, I have a 130 grain bullet loaded for it, 270. I was hoping for a 140. I guess generally speaking, I don't like to go the lightest bullets available for that caliber, nor do I go for the heaviest. Usually the ones that are in the middle of the road, generally speaking, tend to be a little bit more accurate if you're talking factory ammo, factory guns. Not always the case. And I like to, if you go with a middle of the road weight, bullet weight for each caliber, it's just you're hitting the middle of the road. You're not getting the heaviest hitting bullet, but you're not getting the fastest bullet. And at the end of the day, the bullet weight's not going to matter for in a hunting aspect.
Sure.
You know, you talk to Mark, that 10 grains will make a huge difference. If you're shooting long range, if you're within 300 yards, it's not going to matter if it's 150 grains or 180 grains. Both of them are going to do the job. It's really more a matter of what shoots good out of your gun.
Let's bounce back. Let's talk about your pump guns. So why don't you describe a little bit, you went on this pump gun buying rage for a little while. I think you're probably over with that, but you've got a whole host of them now that you're home. I think yep. There are various calibers. Let's kind of walk through, you know, maybe the one that you're going to use this year. You know, what round, is it a built round? Is it a bought round? Just talk a little bit through that with that pump gun. What gun you're using for hunting this year.
All of them. He's using all of them.
I might use all of them. I've got, I went on my buying whim. I was in the hospital when my third child was born and I was bored. And I like those guns. They don't make those guns anymore. So I figured I'd buy one for each of the kids and maybe a couple spares. And so I have various calibers. A good friend of mine, fortunate enough to be friends with a custom woodworker, he actually hand carved a stock so that I could get one to fit the kids. I'm setting them up with the 257 Roberts. Me personally, I'll hunt with two different guns. One of them is a 270 that's got a scope on it, and the other one's a 30-06. And that 30-06 is 100, I think those are the light bullets. They're 150 grain core locks. Shoots good out of it. That one doesn't even have a scope on it. That's, if I'm not sitting in a tree stand, a lot of times I'll carry a gun with a peep sight, open sight, the ghost ring sight in the rear. And the 270, that's got a loophole 3.9x40 on it. I believe that's a 130 grain bullet. And those are just, they're herders. They're cheapos. And they shoot, that's what I found to shoot good out of that gun. And that's a bonded bullet too.
Can I just ask a simple question? And either one of you can respond to this is in our areas, specifically in the northern parts of the state, including other states around us, Vermont, New Hampshire, some of the big areas, and I was in Ontario recently, you know, some of these, the style of hunting is a little unique. It's kind of walk shoot hunting. And, you know, shooting through brush is a big deal in some of those areas. And I would just both, like one of you or both of you, to just talk a little bit about maybe that choice and bullet, or just thought process around having to shoot through brush and getting familiar with that. Maybe Josh, you have more familiarity than Mark. So, you know, either case, you know, why don't you guys just chat about that really quick? Cause I think that's on some folks' mind when they're thinking about, you know, either deer drives or they're hunting different terrain and they've got to make tough shots on animals.
Yeah, that could be what a big reason why I don't go with the splatter bullets. I'm a big fan of the Corlocks. I love the Corlocks. I can't deny that. Yep. They've killed a lot of deer for me, and I do a lot of still hunting. I can't say as though I'm a huge tracker. I've done it. I've missed a lot of deer doing it. Never killed a deer doing it.
Yeah, no. I think I would say, like, the main things is, like, when you're looking at, like, a brush gun, like, there's different opinions on a brush gun. Honestly, if I had to choose, like, one brush gun, I'm probably actually going to shoot, like, a 12 gauge, just because I'm going to be trying to send stuff through as heavy as I can, or a 45-70, something that has a lot of wallop on both ends, but it's got to be able to retain velocity going through that. I mean, I really want to make sure that I blow through that. Like Josh said, I'm not going to go out there and try and shoot my ELDMs or like an SSP or a ballistic tip for Masler. I'm not going to try and shoot that through, you know, some beech brush or anything like that, thinking that I'm going to be able to hit my target. Like, that's just, that's careless, really. And so as far as the brush gun stuff goes, like, I don't know. I'm big into, like, just, that's where I would choose, like, the bonded bullet. And I probably wouldn't even go with an AccuBond. I'd probably be going with more like a partition, or, like I said, the Corlox, something that is designed for high impact velocities and still be able to retain. Cause that's the other thing that goes back to the bonded bullets. Like we were saying, when your impact velocities on a ballistic tip or like a cup and core is going to be more likely to, if it hits something at a higher velocity, to start doing its separation per se. A bonded is going to be a tougher bullet. So, you know, if you happen to shoot through a few more branches than what you think you're going to, there's still a pretty good chance that it's going to hit its target.
Yeah. I think I used to shoot Winchester Partition Golds out of my 1100. And that was a heck of a gun for, I think, those circumstances. Not that that was my method of hunting, but it definitely, you know, it makes sense to me. Big bullet, you know, less impacted by debris. And I think people should practice that. They should put some debris and shoot. I'm sure those big Adirondack hunter folks that probably, some of them probably listen to this podcast, you know, they have a style and system that works well for them. All right, Mark, I want to leave this kind of end of it with you. We've kind of went over time a little bit, so I thank both of you, but anything you want to leave the audience with, and we'll bounce over to Josh, something that I think's relevant or something you want to just have folks consider just from your perspective.
I had a brain fart on this one. I don't know how I kind of let this one slip through my fingers, but the one thing that I meant to touch base on with going back to bullet selection, the one main thing is we're talking about just matching ammunition to a firearm. Yes, it's crucial for that. But one thing that you really need, if you do think you want to either, actually, even if you're not going to go down the wormhole of reloading, you need to kind of have a basic idea as far as what your twist rate is and whether your gun can support it. You know, there's the standard that has always been in the past is, you know, speed kills. So they were, when they came out with like your 300 Win Mag, you know, a lot of these guns, they weren't, when they Sammy approved these things, they were thinking more like, okay, 165 grain bullet or 180 grain bullet on your high end going, you know, 3,200 feet per second or something. About when, after the Creedmoor thing came out back in 2000s, then they started realizing, okay, you know, we can start slowing bullets down. We can go a heavier bullet at a slower speed, and it'll be able to retain, like we were talking about with the BCs and everything. Your barrel, when you look, if not that I'm suggesting look down a barrel, because that's obviously not safe, pull your bolt next time and look down and see the rifling. That is called your twist rate. I'm most like, I would say, traditional guns, your 30-06, your 300 Win Mag,
you know, you're going to be looking anywhere between like 1 in 10 to probably like a 1 in 12 twist, somewhere around there, maybe more like a 1 in 14. That is one full revolution for every 14 inches. That is what I would consider more like a slow twist. So where I'm trying to go with that is copper bullets in particular, even though like you're shooting 160 grain cup and core bullet, if you try and shoot 160 grain copper bullet, remember I said they were going to be longer, you're actually going to need a faster twist rate to stabilize it. If you're trying to shoot a bullet that your barrel cannot stabilize, or your cartridge and barrel combination, because speed also has to come into effect on this, if you can't stabilize that bullet, you're absolutely wasting your time. Like, so say if you, just for an example, Remington 260, the biggest downfall to that rifle is it doesn't have a very good twist rate when they first SAMI approved it, because they didn't have the 140s. They didn't have the 156 burgers. If you tried to shoot, like, say, like a very high BC bullet, thinking you're going to do yourself a world difference and try and make this 260 shoot great, if you're shooting like a 1 in 12 twist out of your 260, you are wasting your time. It is, they are not going to stabilize. Yeah, you might be able to get one bullet that goes down and hits your bullseye, then you shoot five more shots, and you very well could have one that they call key hold, which is literally the bullet going in sideways through your target. So just be aware that, like, if you are looking at a certain particular cartridge, and it, most of the time factory ammo, I'm trying to give some examples in my head, but I guess like maybe some 7 mag stuff and maybe some 300 Win mag stuff, most stuff is going to shoot out of the average 270 or 7 rem mag or the standard twist. Some of these newer guns, they have started making them, like Remington, I think, when they just reintroduced their new line, the Alpha 1 Remington 700 premium ammo that you're just assuming is going to shoot great out of there, and stuff it in your 1969 Remington 700 7 rem mag, there's a very good chance it ain't going to shoot. So just be aware that you have to kind of have an idea. And if you don't know it, there's actually ways that you got to take a cleaning rod with a jag and you mark your thing, and you basically have to figure out how far it is before it does a full revolution. It's very crude, but it does work. So just be aware as far as that goes. And then the other thing, going back to the bullet speed and velocity, barrel length is huge. Like, we have talked about this more, like when we're talking about the guns, but just be aware of, like, for every inch of barrel, you're basically going to be losing like 25 feet per second. So just know that if you're thinking that you want to try and get a bullet that, you know, I'm reading the box right now and it says that, you know, this stuff should be going 3,000 feet per second. Well, there's 270 at, you know, out of a 26 inch barrel. Well, a 20 inch or say a 22 inch even, you know, your velocity is going to be altered by that. So now, you know, your 1,800 foot-pounds or feet per second that you need for the bullet operation was at 600 yards before. It might be 500 yards before. So just be aware of that. Just because the box or just because it says premium on there, that it might not work for your gun. There's a lot of aspects that go into the bullet selection that you should be really going with.
Mark, thanks for that. I think that's an important topic, and I think certainly something not to overlook. And, you know, I'm sure there's some rules of thumb around, you know, the selection, but thinking more through what the actual gun, the spin rate of the gun, et cetera, the whole stabilization process, I had to do a little bit of research in that. And, you know, just in my mind for everyone thinking about this, and I'm going to be very simple-minded in this, is, you know, you want, like, I was playing catch with my son the other day, and we're, you know, he's a football player. We're throwing the ball back and forth. That spin rate of that ball is big. And will it tumble or will it reach the destination without too much, you know, the stabilization, the term that you used earlier, you know, will it stabilize through that flight process? And I think that's critical to the equation, which relates kind of well to this example, twist rate, barrel length, alignment with the bullet weight, all those type of things. So great topic. Josh, let's end it with you. Anything you want to talk about, funny stories, something you did today, anything silly, anything you got going on?
Anything I got going on. Nothing silly happened today, just a lot of work.
Good.
I been hunting, turkey hunting with my kids. That's been a lot of fun.
Good.
Completely off topic, but that was pretty big. I shot a good one. My daughter with me, called him right in 15, 20 yards, gobbling right in her face. So she's hooked now. My son's been a few times, haven't got one with him, but he's certainly loving it. Let's see.
You got the wounded warrior hunt.
Yep. Got the wounded warrior hunt coming up this weekend. So I'm really looking forward to that. That's the highlight of my year. So
do you want to talk quickly about that? Just let folks know what you do and how you support that.
Yeah. Every year we have three, Purple Heart recipients out to, camp down in Truxton. And we take them turkey hunting. Great organization, great thing to do. Dynamic in camp is usually pretty special. Always a good time. Always a good, great guys. You know, all these, they're so humble. Great guy. You know, guys just like us, that they all went to war. You know, the stories that you hear are, it blows my mind listening to these guys tell their stories. So it's pretty cool, pretty special, a lot of fun.
How many years have you been doing that, Josh?
This is our fourth okay. year doing it. Yeah. So this year we got a guy from Florida, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania coming in.
Now you're guiding, right? You're going to take one of the guys out guiding, basically?
Yep, I'm just the guide.
Okay.
I do the drive-in and the call-in, trying to put them on a bird. You know, we're there all weekend. They come in on Thursday afternoons and leave on Mondays, and we're there to cater to whatever they want to do while they're here.
That's awesome. I appreciate that you do that, and you know, happy to hear about that. And I think if hopefully at some point maybe we get somebody from their organization on a podcast here, we'll see. You're working on that, but yeah, I think it's a great thing that you do, and it's great to hear you support that. I know that's a highlight for you, so I'm sure everybody can appreciate the time that you give to that organization, and certainly I think there's some gains that you have out of yourself, but it's just a great overall experience.
All right, for sure.
Yeah, guys, we're at the end of this. I don't mean to cut you short. I could talk to you both all day. We talk all the time, all of us anyhow, so it's nice to have friends on this podcast. That doesn't happen all the time, although I'm friends with pretty much everyone that comes on this, but closer friends like you both. So I appreciate both of you. Mark, thanks for taking time. I know you put a lot of thought into this, and you know, you're just such a wealth of knowledge. You're kind of like the equipment guy for me and Josh. I think we both appreciate that. Josh is the practical guy, and I'm kind of the pie in the sky, the abstract guy. So the combination of the three of us is a pretty, I think, good combo. So thanks, guys.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you both. Well, we'll talk again soon. All right, guys. See ya.
All right. Thanks.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay three nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.